Thanks, Chris. And thanks to all of you for inviting me to give the charge this year. I've never had the opportunity to give the charge before, and like many of you, I wasn't too sure what the charge was. So I tried to do a little research on this so I could get it right. I looked in a lot of sources about UVA, its history in the 19th century and the 20th century, and I couldn't find anything. Nothing about the charge. And then I asked RefDesk to do a little research for me because I had given up. And they were able to find out for me that this particular tradition is only 4 years old. And I had looked forward to being part of a long-standing tradition. Professor Bevere gave the first charge. When she was told that it was the first charge ever given, she was polite. She called it a tradition in the making. Others might call it bait and switch. Settled traditions have the virtue of being well-defined, not so for traditions in the making. So I had to ask a colleague who had attended all four of the charges what they looked like. This is his email. And I was terrified when I got this email. It should include words of encouragement and advice to the graduating class. It should be uplifting if possible. It is appropriate to take a serious tone, or perhaps sometimes a lighter tone, but in no event should it ever be longer than 25 minutes. The email then concludes somewhat ominously, "Don't even try to be funny. Faculty humor is an oxymoron." Well, maybe he was right. When I heard the words serious tone and 25 minutes, I became extremely anxious. And I wondered whether I really had much to offer you, because I really haven't been here that long. As Chris said, I got here around the same time all of you did in the fall of 2005. But I actually got here a little bit later than all of you did. I was about a week late, because I had spent a week before getting here in September of 2005 in New Orleans at Tulane Law School teaching civil procedure. I had taught a week of civil procedure there. I left New Orleans for Charlottesville ahead of Hurricane Katrina. And I'd only been here a couple of days when Associate Dean Jim Ryan called me up and asked me if I was interested in being a substitute teacher, dreaded words, for a large section of civil procedure. I still remember that first day. I was nervous then, too, as those of you who were there must have been as well. I was particularly worried when I saw Dean Jeffries is not here, is he? No. I was particularly worried when I saw Dean Jeffries accompanying me to the classroom on that first day. And for a while, I thought he was, you know, going to stick around and take a seat just to make sure that I didn't foul things up too badly. But he offered some reassuring words to the class, and he let me off with a kind introduction. And that reminds me that you were all very lucky to have had Dean Jeffries as your dean here for your 3 years. He's a person of many talents, and given his parking place in the law school, I think we can all agree John Jeffries is the Cadillac of deans. Anyway, when I started teaching almost 100 of you in the fall of 2005, I didn't expect that I'd be here with you 3 years later, much less that I'd be giving the charge, or that I would be the one who was staying and you would be the ones who are leaving. Which gets me to my theme. And I was told that I needed a theme. I apologize. It's one we've heard a lot of in this election year, but there won't be any politicking from up here. And the theme is change. not change you can believe in. That line's been taken. But change you can count on. And why you shouldn't be afraid of it. As the famous law school dropout Edmund Burke once said, we must all obey the great law of change. It is the most powerful law of nature. The change that I want to focus on this afternoon is change that you will encounter in your professional and in your personal lives. Changes that will present you with challenges and opportunities to adapt. Of course, most of you are already experts at adapting, so just consider this to be something of a heads up. I also want to say something about continuity as a counterweight to change, and along the way I may have to dispense some free advice to you, although it may at least have the virtue of being a little bit contrarian. So I've got four things. I know it's terrible to have a speaker who has a list, but I've got a list. I've got 4 points that I want to make about change, so here goes. Number one, the most obvious change for you is going to be the initial one. Transition from being a student to being an attorney. And I think it's going to be a somewhat more dramatic transformation than you might have supposed. Life has been pretty good for most of you here at UVA. I know it's been hard work. I know there have been challenges. I'll bet most of you ended up working a lot harder than you probably thought you would when you got here. But it's still a pretty idyllic and non-adversarial place. And I think that that's something you're going to miss. Not that the outside world won't have its own pleasures and rewards. It will. But you may have to clean up some of your old habits. I won't be the first one to tell you that most law firms do not work on the semester system. This means that you will not be able to put off your hardest work until the next to last week in April. Also, to my knowledge, there are very few firms or offices that have anything that resembles Feb Club. Unless you're planning on practicing in New Orleans. They have Feb Club, and it's not limited to February. And having been there, I at least also want to add that New Orleans subscribes to the views of a founding father other than Thomas Jefferson. New Orleans adheres to the select teachings of Benjamin Franklin, because it was Benjamin Franklin who said, "Beer is proof that God exists and that he wants us to be happy." Speaking of beer, you've probably all seen the vault rankings of law firms. I don't know if you know that earlier this month they came out with their first ever ranking of law schools. UVA ranks fourth. But the hiring partners' assessments of UVA grads is interesting. Nearly all of them are incredibly positive. I'll read you a couple. And I'm just the messenger here, okay? I'm just reading this. "We have consistently hired top-notch attorneys from UVA. They are well-rounded with quality skills in all areas. And the law school develops students with solid legal and analytical skills. And this reminded me of a song that I once heard, I wish they all could be UVA grads." But one of the comments focused in on the secret, not a very well-kept secret, of UVA's happiness. And here it is. "Generally, they're great, but sometimes I wonder about their work ethic." Maybe it's the law school's emphasis on softball and beer. Spoken like someone who did not get into UVA. In any event, most of you probably already have a pretty good idea of the kind of law you want to practice and where you want to practice it and with whom you want to practice. It's good to have a plan. Don't be surprised if things don't go quite as planned. Earlier this month, Professor Monahan gave a wonderful talk that included a number of revealing statistics about the UVA Law School class of 1990 and what's happened to them over the course of the past 18 years. There's another, more generalized set of statistics that two other scholars have put together called 10 Years After the JD. And while these particular statistics are not UVA specific, they're also revealing. And what jumped out at me most of all was job mobility. You will change your jobs more quickly and more often than you might suppose. Fully a third of law school grads change jobs once in the first 3 years out of law school, and that doesn't include years during which some of you might clerk for a judge. Other studies show that lawyers tend to change jobs on average, 3 times during the first 10 years out, again, not including clerkships. In addition, although there are a lot of lawyers who enter large firm practice who will eventually leave it, the study shows that total job changeover during the early years out of law school is actually less for those of you who go into large firm practice and somewhat greater, that is to say, the turnover for those of you who go to smaller firms or go into government practice or public service. I know you probably hear a lot of complaints about practice in a big firm. I'm here to tell you that I think that large firms get a bum rap. Many of you will choose to stay in such firms, and for many good reasons. And even if you leave for greener pastures, they're a great place to start. You can learn a lot of law, you can learn a lot about lawyering, you will make good friends, and you will be well compensated. And one other thing worth noting, big law firms have some of the best pro bono practices out there, and it makes it easy for you to do some good while still living in the relative comfort of big firm practice. So whatever you decide to do, and whatever your well-laid plans are for the moment, don't be afraid of this kind of inevitable professional change. Take advantage of it. Most every job change is described as a personal and professional plus by those who make the change. Another aspect of change that you can expect is legal change. Sometimes change just happens. The doctrinal content of some areas that you studied in law school will undergo a shift, sometimes a dramatic shift. I was at a reunion of my law school class 5 years ago, and while we were all waiting around for our group pictures to be taken, there was the class of 1938. It's not my class. And I found myself thinking, as I was waiting for my picture to be taken, as I often do in such situations, about Erie versus Tompkins. And I realized that this group of people, when they were taking first-year civil procedure or whatever it was that they took back then, Erie hadn't been decided. But it was decided before they graduated. Same's true for the adoption of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. And of course, constitutional law underwent an enormous number of changes between 1935, when they first went there, and the year that they graduated, 1938. For all of you, it would be like, just after taking civil procedure, the drafters went out and changed each and every one of the federal rules before you graduated or took the bar exam, which in fact they did 4 months ago. So I say to all of you, good luck learning the new federal rules of civil procedure. Big or small, doctrinal change is something you can count on. And maybe this will help you appreciate the emphasis on theory and analysis in your classes, even your so-called meat and potatoes kinds of classes, because it's those analytical skills that you've acquired here that'll do you the most good in the long run. For example, when you came here, you were bombarded with a lot of questions, presented with a lot of different fact hypos, with different precedents, and asked how a particular case would come out. As a beginner, you ultimately had to respond, I don't know. But now, after 3 years of intense legal training and analysis, you are met with those same questions, hypotheticals, and precedents, and asked how a particular case should come out. And you can confidently respond, it depends. Of course, remembering a little doctrine can save you from embarrassment. There's the famous, if apocryphal, and it is famous, an apocryphal story of the Yale student who thought she'd be dealing mostly with civil rights cases during her clerkship with a federal judge because the federal judge had told her that most of his docket consisted of diversity cases. But back to legal change. In addition to simply being on the experiencing end of legal change, some of you may find yourselves acting as agents of legal change, and more power to you. There are a lot of areas of law in need of change. At many levels, in many venues, here and abroad, it's an unfortunate fact of life, but you can count on the fact that there will be no shortage of wrongs that need to be righted or bad laws in need of repair. On the other hand, there will be many of you who will find yourself in the position of resisting arguments for legal change, and more power to you as well, because there are many areas of law that are working just fine, and the hand of law reform can only make things worse. I've always liked the old saying from Victorian England. You may not like it as much as I do, but I've always liked the saying from Victorian England, reform? Don't speak to me of reform. Things are bad enough as they are. Well, that was funny in 1896. I don't mean to single out a particular area of law to indicate how it is that the hand of law reform can do more harm than good, but take the area of conflict of laws. As As one of my colleagues said, this is an area that in 1934 was functioning perfectly well. But then conflict of laws got in the hands of legal reformers. And today, it is widely recognized to be a mess. Ask anybody who's taken my class in conflict of laws this semester, and they would readily agree. Conflicts is a classic example of an area that was once not in need of any particular reform, that because of reform is now in particular need of reform. But as you will learn, one of the many things lawyers are good at is cleaning up after the mistakes of other lawyers. Number three, and now it gets interesting, your personal lives. There will also be changes, perhaps momentous changes, and ideally these should come as no surprise. Today, a majority of you are single, and most of you are not raising kids. Things will be different for many of you when you return for your fifth reunion, and they will likely be different for most of you when you return for your tenth. The tenth reunion may sound like it is a long way away, but one thing that sneaks up on you when you get older is a change in the perception of the passage of time. It's a cliche, is it not, that each successive day is a fractionally smaller part of your life than was the day that went before. But I'm not referring to that aspect of diminishing returns. I am referring to the fact that you will just be very busy with professional obligations, and time will become something you wish you had more of. I'm supposed to charge you, I think, at various points along the way. So I would charge you first and foremost to guard your time jealously. It's a precious commodity, and no graduation talk would be complete that did not, in effect, tell you to take time to smell the roses, to make time for your family, your friends, and for yourself. I don't know if any of you have had the misfortune of reading a book called Tuesdays with Maury. It's not really a book. It's more like a pamphlet. But it sold 11 million copies. It's about a guy who goes to visit this aging former professor of his named Maury. How often? Every Tuesday. And the professor dispenses the same wisdom in every chapter. They're not really chapters either. They're basically extended paragraphs. And the common refrain is, love your friends, love your family, and best of all, forgive yourself. This is very good advice, but the book was so tedious that it made you realize that you can overdo even the best of things, and that what you really need is a kind of balance. So, after you've forgiven yourself, and after you've taken the time to smell the roses, my advice might be, go back to work. There's nothing wrong with being devoted to your professional life, just as you are to your family and your friends, and being successful at work can be quite fulfilling. As long as I'm on the subject, just let me say that I've never understood why the work of lawyering should be talked of as alienating, or why it shouldn't be an enjoyable and integral part of your life. Of course, this is coming from one of your professors, and most of us have abandoned the everyday practice of law, so maybe it's easy for me to say. But if we didn't love it, we wouldn't be doing it. I mean, if we didn't love teaching, if we didn't love the legal profession, if we didn't love the idea of training lawyers to actually engage in practice, we wouldn't do it. The best advice I ever got was as a graduate student in a PhD program in classical languages and literature. And I got this advice from my own version of Maury, this crusty old professor from Austria. Actually, he was more of the anti-Maury. And frankly, his advice was advice that I resented at the time because I thought it was insulting. But his advice was, find out what you're good at, and happiness will usually follow. I'm pleased to report that I left the classics department a year later. I went to law school, and I have been happy ever after. So I would charge you to work hard, and to work hard at something you enjoy doing. And if you can't seem to find out what it is you enjoy, try doing what you're good at. Failing that, get a hobby. Number four. Maybe the most difficult change you will encounter is change that comes from having to deal with clients and attorneys. Start with clients. It's an unusual relationship. On the one hand, you are their agent and their fiduciary. You stand in for them and you speak for them. Some say this can create dissonance, a gap between your own beliefs and those that you espouse on behalf of the client, as if to suggest that dissonance is necessarily bad. I'm not sure that dissonance is necessarily bad. Some dissonance can be a good thing. I think it's the natural tendency of the lawyer, in fact, to identify too closely with the client, not the opposite. And that kind of closeness is not helpful. It can make you lose your objectivity, and it can push you to give advice that is not the best advice. One of my colleagues who teaches professional responsibility likes to quote a well-known member of the New York Bar who said, quote, 80% of the practice of law is telling the client that they're a damned fool and that they can't do what they want to. All of us can think, from that definition, of poorly advised clients. Some of them in the news, from certain players on my favorite team, the New York Yankees, to presidents, and that's plural, and their administrations. Clients whose lawyers gave them the advice that the lawyer perceived that they wanted to hear, rather than the advice that they needed to hear. And the needs of clients, when coupled with the press of time, can create professional temptations. Temptations to cut corners, temptations to be less than duly diligent, and worse, temptations to shave the truth. You don't need me to tell you to resist those temptations or to keep a moral compass. And if your compass gets stuck, and I mean this, to seek someone out whose compass is working and whose advice you can trust. I don't need to tell you these things, but this is the charge. So I am telling you anyway. I therefore charge you to do the right thing and to remember to tell your client he's a damn fool and can't do what he wants to. Next, lawyers. Learning to deal with other attorneys in an adversarial setting is not anything that law school or anything else other than practice can prepare you for. Many lawyers are quite civil in their behavior. I would assume most UVA lawyers fit into that category. But lawyers can be a disagreeable lot, and a few of them will be downright unpleasant. And when there are, there'll be an understandable urge to respond in kind, and then some. But I would encourage you to resist that urge. You can always afford to take the high road. Opposing counsel, trust me, will be baffled by your decency and unflappability. They might even learn a thing or two about good manners. Softball, beer, and good manners. Those are our subspecialties. Now, having talked a bit about change, let me say one or two things about continuity, and then I'll let you go. First, you've made some good friendships here. Don't let them lapse. Don't wait until the next reunion to get back in touch. And if you think the reunions are a bunch of sentimental nonsense, get over it and attend them anyway. Second, you've all accomplished quite a lot, and a lot about which you can be justly proud. Getting in here, getting through here, and getting out of here. But there are a lot of challenges and accomplishments ahead of you, and you should continue to demand a lot from yourselves, just as you have here. Third, although you're leaving UVA, I hope your good feelings for this institution remain with you forever. So does the fundraising office, whose personnel will remain with you forever. And let me remind you, all of us here are incredibly fortunate to be at this institution, not just you as students, but we as the faculty. We're very lucky to have been able to teach you and to have had you here. I'm obviously very lucky to be able to make this place my new home. As others will point out to you, you are about to become part of the most institutionally loyal band of alums of any law school. And since this is the only law school most of you have likely seen up close and personal, you may have the impression that what you have here is replicated elsewhere and perhaps even improved upon. You couldn't be more wrong. There may be a few schools that rival the academic lineup here, such as those who have the habit of rating our faculty. But then why shouldn't they have a faculty the equal of ours? And perhaps there's a school somewhere that rivals the quality of teaching here, or the quality of students, although I'm skeptical, or the quality of student life. No way. But there is no place that combines them all quite as well as UVA does. And in the likely event that you don't see this already, I think you'll begin to see it after you step out of here. So for my last charge, and in all seriousness, I would charge you to be true to your school, and of course to be generous. And as one who came in here with you, and who has gotten to know many of you quite well, let me close by saying, congratulations to all of you, good luck to all of you, and give yourselves a great big round of applause.